Part 2. Butterflies. Chapter 6. The Middle of a Haircut. The Antioch Dunes National Wildlife Refuge sits at the very edge of Antioch, California, an economically haggard suburb an hour east of San Francisco. It's a narrow band of land at the anonymous, industrialized fringes of town, the kind of place not easily reached by any bus line, but around the corner from the large asphalt yard where a transit company parks its buses at night. The refuge is bordered by the San Joaquin River to the north, and across the road to the south, a sewage treatment plant. Its parking lot abuts a waste transfer station and a diner called the Red Caboose, a converted old Santa Fe Railroad train car that is popular with bikers. At only 67 acres, Antioch Dunes is among the very smallest of America's national wildlife refuges. You could walk straight from one end of it to the other in under an hour, if it weren't for the tremendous Georgia-Pacific Antioch Wallboard plant, which, built before the refuge was established, still stands on a block of privately held land, splitting the refuge in two. The wallboard factory, which everyone calls the gypsum plant, is a daunting facility, with its own water tower and container ship dock on the river. It makes drywall and emits a low-pitched thrum that you can hear when you're walking around the refuge. Sometimes gypsum dust, a chalky white powder, drifts over the dunes and settles on the leaves of plants. I spent a lot of time at Antioch Dunes and grew to really like the place, but the fact is it's hard to describe the refuge without sounding as if you're insulting it. Even calling it Antioch Dunes can sound snide, since there have been virtually no recognizable sand dunes here for at least 20 or 30 years. Long before the federal government bought and protected the land in the 1980s, the sand that had piled up spectacularly was gradually trucked away to make bricks and roads and at least one horse racing track, until it was virtually all gone, dug down to near the water table in places, and a rowdy garden of shrubby, non-native weeds and trees soon sunk in its roots. In an essay titled, In Memoriam, the Antioch Dunes, a botanist accused the landowners who sold that sand of converting the area's permanently uncommon value into transient cash and forever leaving the people of California that much more bankrupt in soul and spirit. He was writing in 1969, arguably before the place went most dramatically downhill. Recently, one afternoon in late August, a Fish and Wildlife Service employee named Louis Terrazas was showing a group of volunteers a large aerial photo of Antioch Dunes, giving us the lay of the land. We had assembled on the smaller of the two halves of the refuge, east of the gypsum plant, to count butterflies. Louis brought cookies and sunscreen for everyone. As we helped ourselves, he leaned the photo against the torso of a squat, slightly thuggish guy in camouflage shorts named Steve, using him like an easel. When I'd asked Steve what brought him out to count butterflies, he told me, "I'm here because I was a bad, bad boy." It was a long story, which I couldn't really follow, having to do with Steve's tendency to run stop signs while doing a paper route at 3 in the morning, but the upshot was that a judge finally got tired of slapping Steve on the wrist and sentenced him to some whopping number of community service hours. He was handed a list of possible jobs. Louis was the only guy on the list who called him back. We were here to count a specific kind of butterfly, the Lang's metal mark, a little known but very critically endangered species. Antioch Dunes is the only place on Earth where the Lang's metal mark lives. There are also two endangered flowering plants here, the Contra Costa wallflower and the Antioch Dunes evening primrose. The refuge is the only one in the nation set aside for endangered plants and insects. As a baseline for the butterfly's conservation, the government needs to establish each year's peak count, or the highest number of Lang's spotted on a single afternoon. In the 90s, peak counts reached into the thousands, but the species was flirting with extinction, Louis now told us. In the summer of 2006, the Fish and Wildlife Service had been shocked to find that the population had suddenly crashed. Peak count was only 45 that year, which is to say, that all the Lang's metalmark butterflies known to exist on Earth one afternoon could have fit inside a French press. So, I wouldn't see them in my backyard, said an older woman in a Puerto Vallarta baseball cap. She'd adjusted her voice mid-sentence so that, by the end, she was clearly answering, more than asking, a question. There were 16 of us volunteers, a few older couples, a garrulous former oil industry grunt at Chevron, a college student with a day-glow tiger tattoo on her back who'd heard about the butterfly count on Craigslist. Except for Steve, the traffic violator, we were all here because we wanted to be, for the benefit of the butterfly, or our own benefit, or some inscrutable intertwinement of the two. Butterflies occupy a special place in our imaginative wildernesses, transcending their status as bugs. They don't sting, bite, buzz in your ear, or scamper across your kitchen floor. If you woke up to find one had alighted on your nose, you'd lie perfectly still, puzzling out whatever beneficent message the cosmos must be communicating to you, whereas you wouldn't do this if you woke up with a banana slug on your nose, or a cockroach. We see butterflies as delicate, uncorrupted, which is probably why we're so keen to paint them on our daughters' cheeks at birthday parties or stitch them in glittery thread on their pajamas. We had to invent unicorns and fairies to keep little girls company. But we let the butterflies in, too, just as nature made them. In that sense, the story of the Langs first sounded to me like a melancholy children's book. A fragile, beautiful butterfly had been gradually hemmed in on all sides by filth and modernity until its home, fenced off, closed to the public, faded into a kind of forgotten badland. Stolen cars have turned up at Antioch Dunes. Once, Louis told me, a biologist found the body and head of a dead pig in two separate black garbage bags dumped at the front gate. And a short drive away is the house that belonged to Philip Garrido, who kidnapped 11-year-old J.C. Dugard in 1991, held her in a warren of outbuildings in his backyard for 18 years, and fathered two daughters by her. In our imaginations, butterfly habitat is always a pretty place on a beautiful day. But somehow the Lang's metal mark had persisted here long enough to attract some human attention. Not much, but enough, in our age of conservation reliance, to change everything. The Antioch Dunes came apart slowly. It took the entirety of the 20th century for them to devolve into what they are now. The butterfly was tossed around on the surface of that confusion. There were, I'd find, people tossed around, too. People who loved the place and other neglected landscapes like it, and tried to counteract the entropy taking hold. I found their stories rising and falling in the history of the Antioch Dunes, almost cyclically. Each generation of idealists was running after butterflies, trying to save them but never quite catching up, until, having watched so much nature deteriorate in their lifetimes, they finally buckled over, jaded. And just as they did, without fail, the next generation of idealists would appear, obliviously hitting their stride. I wanted to trace the changes at this one specific tract of land across all that time. But looking so closely at an insignificant-seeming bug, at an insignificant-seeming place, eventually drew me into deep uncertainty about so much else. It turns out that the Lang's metal mark flies in a confounding and counterintuitive wilderness, where some of our most comforting ideas about nature unravel. I kept chasing the butterfly, wherever it led me. And before I knew it, I was all the way back at conservation's first principles, faced with petrifying questions like, what exactly are we preserving, and why? Questions worth asking, even if they can't be answered. Louis passed around some large laminated photos of the Lang's metal mark, so we would recognize it in the field. It was orange and black and looked to me like a smaller monarch butterfly, but probably only in the way that all unfamiliar meat tastes like chicken to the uninitiated. This was the middle of the Lang's flight period, he explained, the few weeks every summer when the butterflies emerge from their cocoons and zip from place to place, mating and laying eggs. It lasts about a month, until they've all been picked off by dragonflies or succumbed to old age. Butterflies live hard and fast. It was up to us volunteers to form a long line and pace every transect of the dunes with handheld clicker counters, trying to spot the butterflies one by one as they quivered through the air. The trick, Louis said, was to stay in line. Anyone who got too far ahead might spook a Langs and flush it out of the plants before it could be positively ID'd. Also, we had to keep looking behind us for butterflies scattering in our wake. It sounded hard. "You ready?" Louis shouted. He gave the signal, and we began creeping through the brush. We moved in almost perfect lockstep for a few paces. Then someone saw something and shouted. Someone else yelled, "No, I think it's a buckeye," noting that the buckeye butterfly, also pictured in Louis's mugshots, was bigger than the Langs. "We got one over here," I heard Louis yell from the far end of the line. He wanted everyone to keep walking in formation, but our heads were turned now, and there was an immediate and unmistakable drifting to the right, toward Louis and the butterfly. Then someone on the opposite end of the line yelled, "There's another one right here," and some of us started drifting that way, too. "Is that a second one?" one older woman asked. "There's one right here, too," a man hollered. "Rock on," someone said. "Oh, here's a third one," a woman shouted, though it was unclear whether one of the first butterflies had merely jittered through her line of sight. There was a fifth and sixth sighting, maybe more. Fingers were firing on the clicker counters. "We've got another one here," Louis yelled. It was a monstrously eventful and confusing 10 seconds. And in that pandemonium, it was immediately clear just how unscientific this process was going to be. The very baseline understanding of the species' health was being provided by us, a bunch of civilians, who had only just been shown a photo of the bug a moment ago. And yet this is a common situation. As the budget for protecting endangered species and managing wildlife has stayed relatively stagnant, but the workload has exploded, more of that work has fallen to a standing army of curious and often retired volunteers. Citizen scientists whom Princeton ecologist David Wilcove has compared to volunteer firefighters. In Maine, they count moose and frogs. In Ohio, they snatch Lake Erie water snakes out of the water and measure them. When the excitement was over, Louis went around to the witnesses individually to reconstruct what had happened. He felt confident that the tally ought to be capped at 5. Then he called us back to take a good look at the first Langs metal mark, which was sitting obligingly still on the stalk of a buckwheat plant. We huddled around it. The girl with the tiger tattoo took a picture with her iPhone. I squatted and looked at the butterfly for a long time. It was the size of a quarter. The wings were rimmed in black with white speckles, then gave way to sunbursts of deep orange. I'd seen lots of photos of the species before that afternoon, but the butterfly was always blown up and perfectly centered in the shot. Looking at it now for the first time in the wild, seeing it as a tiny blotch on a big leaf with so much air and space and civilization around it, brought a deflating new sense of scale. The bug seemed vulnerable to the point of helplessness. You wanted somehow to zoom in, to make it feel important and central again, a worthy protagonist of the bizarre, generations-long saga that's played out at Antioch Dunes on its behalf. You wanted to make the butterfly look big again. And this could be why one of the older women in our group had taken to her knees only a couple of inches from the leaf and was now examining the butterfly through binoculars. Once, the Antioch Dunes were what ecologists call a disturbance ecosystem. The landscape was in motion, slow motion. Wind-driven sand gradually piled into new dunes, and older dunes periodically collapsed. Certain plants thrived in that unruly environment, while the seeds of newcomers were never able to get a foothold in the shifting sand. One native that's well adapted to this cycle is a tall, spindly plant with muted white flowers called naked-stem buckwheat. The buckwheat is the Langs metal mark's host plant. Every butterfly lays its eggs on a particular host plant, and whereas some species of butterflies are promiscuous, laying on a variety of plants, others, like the langs, are committed to a single one. Strictly speaking, the host plant is the butterfly's habitat, the platform it needs to survive, like sea ice for polar bears. Butterflies will thrive in even the most totally run-down-looking or artificial landscape if they find enough host plant there. In Miami, conservationists have expanded the range of a species called the Atala by planting its host plant in highway medians and attracting the butterfly there, into the middle of traffic. If you watched a time-lapse film of Antioch dunes, you'd see, as dunes formed and fell asynchronously around the property over the decades, different plant species mushrooming and then dying back on top of the dunes in a predictable succession. The buckwheat is part of that succession. Every summer, some metalmark eggs laid on stands of buckwheat the previous year will turn into butterflies and take flight. Others will have had their plants senesce or the dunes blown out from under them. As certain encampments of butterflies dwindle, butterflies from other, nearby stands of buckwheat skitter in to lay eggs there and supplement them, what's known as the rescue effect. Or they pioneer new colonies elsewhere, as new patches of buckwheat mature into good habitat. Around the dunes, individual colonies of Lang's metalmarks will grow and die out chaotically. It's not uncommon for the total number of butterflies in this kind of metapopulation to spike and dip dramatically from year to year. But in the aggregate, the metapopulation survives. There's enough of a cushion so it can recover from any losses. But that cycle at Antioch Dunes has now ground to a stop. With the sand largely gone, dunes have stopped rising and collapsing. And without that disturbance, invasive plants could settle into the stable ground and overpower the native ones. The stands of buckwheat have become fewer and farther between. An individual Lang's metalmark may never venture more than 1,000 feet from the buckwheat plant it hatches on. The range within which it can lay its eggs is extremely limited. So the distance between certain butterfly colonies can easily become insurmountable, cutting off the rescue effect. One big metapopulation fractures into smaller, isolated islands, each clinging to its buckwheat and surrounded by an uncrossable sea of weeds. In recent years, the most recklessly spreading weed has been a scraggly, purple-flowered legume with a sinister-sounding name to boot. It's called hairy vetch. The insidiousness of hairy vetch and the many levels of damage it does can't easily be summed up. In some cases, the vetch physically wraps itself around buckwheat plants and steals their sun. The plant is Louis Terrazas' nemesis. As the primary person assigned by the Fish and Wildlife Service to manage the habitat at the dunes, he spends his year in one long counterattack against the vetch. Theoretically, he can mow, whack, or blast pesticides at it from a backpack sprayer, but he has to be careful not to harm any stands of buckwheat in the process, since they may have Lang's larvae on them, or any of the federally endangered plants at the refuge, which he painstakingly marks in advance with fluorescent orange flags. Truthfully, a lot of Louis's job comes down to yanking vetch out of the ground by hand. When I first visited, a few months before the butterfly count, Louis was throwing everything he had at the vetch, trying, alongside the occasional community service worker, to whip the landscape into shape before the butterflies started breaking free from their cocoons later that summer. But the vetch was still everywhere. "This place eats our lunch," Louis confessed. He pointed out areas that he'd cleared that spring, but which the vetch was already recolonizing. Elsewhere, other non-native plants, like ripgut brome and yellow star thistle, had crept in to fill the niche that Louis had torn the vetch from. "Right now," he said, "we're kind of like in the middle of a haircut, like when you look in the mirror and say, 'Man, this isn't looking so good.'" But in a sense, that haircut will never end. It's easy to call the vetch a weed and rip it out of the ground to give the buckwheat some space. but the place has changed so completely that on some level, the weeds now belong at Antioch Dunes more than the native plants do. They are hardier, thriving, better adapted to the new ecosystem that human beings didn't realize they were creating by taking away all that sand. Keeping the Lang's metal mark at Antioch Dunes means keeping the naked stem buckwheat there. But that now means keeping someone like Louis Terrazas there, too, forever slogging around the property with a weed whacker. If the butterfly is going to survive, we have to simulate the disturbance in the ecosystem now. We have to be the wind. As another Fish and Wildlife employee told me at the dunes one afternoon, this place will never run on its own. There'd been wariness of conservation reliance like this looming in the back and forth over whether Dan Cox should have fed those starving polar bear cubs in his video. Lost in the ignorance and outrage were a few sensible people who claimed to understand the problem of climate change perfectly, and to understand that feeding individual polar bears wasn't going to remedy the larger, more horrible situation. But they still wondered if we should be feeding the Hudson Bay bears anyway. Because, like it or not, that's what might be necessary now to keep those animals in the world. Conservationists cast any long-term effort to feed polar bears as logistically problematic, prohibitively expensive, and dangerous. But it's also philosophically ugly. Making polar bears dependent on us for their very survival in such a hands-on way can feel just as much of a defeat as letting them die out. It would mean conceding that their ecosystem is irreparably broken and that we have to be responsible for them in perpetuity, not just step in temporarily to save them. It feels too much like playing God, even if, arguably, that's exactly what we've become. After all, we're the ones who upset so many ecosystems in the first place. We override the natural course of evolution when we endanger species, too, not just when we try to save them. Still, once you purposefully cross that line, it's not clear where you would draw a new one. Some people write to polar bear biologists suggesting that we feed polar bears. Others imagine melting down plastic soda bottles to build motorized rafts so that the bears can float around the Arctic as the ice disappears. Once you go hands-on, in other words, you have to decide when you're going to take your hands off. As J. Michael Scott, the conservation biologist who helped coin the term conservation reliance, put it to me, I could keep polar bears alive in San Diego if I really wanted to. And yet here at Antioch, on behalf of a tiny butterfly that no one's ever heard of, on a refuge where no one goes, America seems to have quietly blown past that threshold a long time ago without ever really considering these questions. With the Langs, as with countless other endangered species, we've gone all in, dramatically manipulating and administering its ecosystem to promote its survival, sending Louis out there to groom the dunes to accommodate the butterfly's predilections and plant new arrangements of its favorite plant, as though he were the landscaper of some aristocrat's country estate. Which is not to say that it's working. That afternoon in August, we were embarking on the 6th volunteer butterfly count of the summer at Antioch Dunes. The surveys had begun 3 weeks ago, but no one had spotted any butterflies until a couple of days earlier, when a single Lang's was seen on the opposite side of the gypsum plant. That is, when we started that morning, peak count was 1. We didn't see any more Lang's after that initial burst of 5. One day the following week, the count hit 28. But that would prove to be peak count for the year. It was a new all-time low and sent those working on the recovery scrambling. One of the last transects we surveyed that afternoon was on some of the refuge's highest ground, a weedy dune with an old utility tower on it, once used to anchor power lines before running them across the river. The lines now ran through a second, newer tower, across a bowl-shaped valley on another equally high hill. Louis positioned us in a line abutting the bottom of the tower. Some of our waists were actually touching the rusted crossbar at its base. We had to survey the land under the tower, which meant that, on Louis' signal, some of us would be climbing over that steel bar into the tower's skeletal interior, then clambering between the metal cables and support structures and out the other side. If anyone had managed to keep up the fantasy that we were spending the day in a pristine wilderness, this conclusively killed it. Just as Louis was about to say go, one of the volunteers noticed a gap in our line. His name was Liam O'Brien, and he'd been fighting back a measure of cynicism all day. "I'll go over here in the gap," he shouted. "God forbid any metal marks are there." Liam is an energetic and knowledgeable butterfly lover who, when we'd first gone around a circle introducing ourselves that afternoon, elicited speechlessness and some actual gasps by relaying that he'd been out to Count Lang's in 1997 and that they'd counted more than 2,200 of them that day. He is 48 and lanky, with styled, whitening hair. He tends to move and speak in choppy, purposeful bursts. Just a moment earlier, he'd whirled around, tracking a fast-moving flickering in the air for as long as he could with his finger and shouted, "That looks like a dog face! That's a California dog face!" hoping to give everyone the opportunity to see California's state butterfly. At one point, as we shuffled between transects, Liam whispered to me, "I'm not the annoying butterfly guy, am I?" I started to tell him that I didn't think he was. He was offering his little factoids in a helpful, totally egoless way. But something caught his eye, and he shot off in another direction. "Heliotrope," I heard him say. "Great, great plant." Liam and I had driven to the dunes together that day. I'd met him earlier in the summer in San Francisco and would occasionally seek him out at the cafe where he has coffee every morning to bounce butterfly questions off him. He made his living with butterflies. He led butterfly walking tours in San Francisco every spring and summer. He painted butterflies to illustrate trail signs for local parks. He'd started a small, neighborhood-wide recovery of a butterfly called the Green Hairstreak and, despite being mostly self-taught, had also spearheaded the government's reintroduction of the endangered Mission Blue to a hilltop in San Francisco called Twin Peaks. That afternoon's metal mark count had left Liam in an introspective mood. Driving home, he told me that as much as he loved butterflies, he wondered if the whole enterprise to save the Langs was becoming a little foolish. The tsunami of change that's going on at that place, with the non-native weeds, you want to know, is this just an exercise in futility? What is it going to take to put these pieces of a puzzle back together when the puzzle itself has already changed? He wondered about his own butterfly conservation projects in the city, too, whether he was wasting his time, whether, via some indiscernible chain of causes and effects, he might even be doing more harm to the environment than good. "Totally possible," Liam said. There was no way of knowing. But in the end, he told me, "I just want to be part of a generation that tries." Chapter 7. Shifting Baselines. Butterflies swarmed the center of Liam O'Brien's life abruptly, 15 years before I met him. Before that, he'd spent a decade as a professional actor. He mostly appeared on stage, doing Shakespeare and musicals, but he got a short-lived break in film in 1990 when he was cast alongside David Cassidy in a hokey sci-fi comedy called Spirit of 76. Liam played an evil geek named Rodney Snodgrass. 6 years later, he was living in San Francisco, working as an understudy in a production of Angels in America. And that was when it happened. A tether snapped tight between Liam O'Brien and butterflies. One day, he saw a butterfly with wings of electric yellow and smudgy black landing in the garden outside his bedroom window. It was a western tiger swallowtail, a native of San Francisco. Liam had always kept a notebook of illustrations, a kind of visual journal, and the next thing he knew, he was out in the garden with his pens and watercolors, capturing the swallowtail on paper. Soon he was touring around California in his Econoline van, painting and drawing as many of the state's butterfly species as he could find. In 1998, Liam tested positive for HIV. He'd been losing his motivation to compete for acting gigs, and in a way, the virus gave him permission to focus on the thing that made him happiest, butterflies. He set out to learn more, to collect names and explanations for what he was seeing. He went to annual butterfly counts and started hanging around some of the most respected butterfly scientists, or lepidopterists, in the Bay Area. A clatch of stoic, sometimes crotchety old men, they were mainly men, accustomed, since childhood, to chasing butterflies through woods, bogs, and canyons by themselves. Liam, on the other hand, is a snarky, spirited gay man with a big, booming voice and no scientific background. "I didn't get a PhD in dissecting butterfly penises," he told me. But somehow, he managed to win that crowd over. He found it ironic. We associate butterflies with feminine, gentle things. People use the terms butterfly chaser and mariposa as slang for gay men. But I just happen to be gay. I go to the Lepidopterist Society's annual meetings, and I've never seen such a collection of shabby, straight men in my life. One of Liam's mentors gave him a piece of advice. Learn where you live. Dig deep and study what's around you. So in 2007, Liam decided to conduct his own exhaustive survey of San Francisco's butterflies, trying to see which butterfly species historically found within the city limits survived there. He spent more than 200 days in the field that year, walking the defunct naval yard, the oceanfront scrub, and the weedy hillsides between posh Victorian houses, noticing which butterflies flew where. He was looking around, getting to know his neighbors. Butterfly-wise, the San Francisco Bay Area happens to be a national treasure. The profusion of butterfly species in the region is arguably unparalleled in the United States. There were as many as 57 before the gold rush. This diversity is a function of the severe changes in climate across the region, from dank, wet, and foggy to sunny and hot. Even temperatures in different neighborhoods of San Francisco can differ by 25 degrees on a given day. This patchwork of microclimates creates something akin to the Galapagos Islands for butterflies, with different species and subspecies attuned to each area. In 1849, a French lawyer came to the region in search of gold, but wound up chasing butterflies instead. He discovered about 43 new species, 8 from San Francisco proper. The city became a hotspot for lepidopterists in the late 19th century. It was a time before biology and natural history had professionalized as fields, when a lawyer with a good eye and durable walking shoes could make valuable contributions. The most accomplished lepidopterists of the era were weekend warriors. One was a professional stage actor, like Liam. Another, Hans Hermann Baer, a physician, was once described as always in danger of falling into forgetfulness on professional subjects when he caught sight of a butterfly he ardently wanted. Butterfly collecting wasn't a dignified hobby. It was seen as childish and useless, dorky. Although the stigma wasn't ever erased, a more glamorous, swashbuckling counterimage of the collector did momentarily emerge. It was best embodied by one of Dr. Baer's pupils, a San Francisco police officer named James Cottle. Cottle was a huge, barrel-chested patrolman whose powerful fist, it was said, was more effective than his billy club. He performed heroically during the earthquake and fire of 1906, and once infiltrated a masquerade ball dressed as the Duke of Wellington to catch jewel thieves. In a 1910 profile headlined, "By day he catches burglars, by night he catches bugs," the San Francisco Call presented the cop as a brawny rejoinder to the image of entomologists as blue, spectacled old men with long hair and pasty faces peering into slimy pools. Cottle himself had once felt that way about butterfly lovers. But he now understood that collecting butterflies was macho, athletic stuff. He claimed to have once trudged across 38 miles of problematic wilderness in pursuit of a single butterfly, the way hunters tracked bears. Elsewhere, there were stories of men dangling hundreds of feet down the side of a cliff to capture a particular species of butterfly. Cottle called butterfly collecting the healthiest life in the world and the greatest sport I know anything about. A few months spent charging alongside him would cure tuberculosis, he said. Guaranteed. Boosters played up the monetary value of rare specimens. In the Bay Area especially, all the breathy fantasies of the gold rush were recast around butterflies. There were fortunes to be made in these flying nuggets of gold. All you had to do was reach up and swing a net. With new laws and conservation organizations like the Audubon Society making other popular naturalist hobbies like bird and bird egg collecting problematic, some of that attention shifted to butterflies. And while the nature fakers were sympathetically anthropomorphizing wolves and bears, it was tough to feel bad about killing butterflies, particularly since they disappeared en masse at the end of their seasonal flight periods anyway. They were like the leaves, which painlessly dropped from the trees. As one how-to guide for collectors put it, their lives are so brief, what can it matter? There are no cases in which over-collecting was the major cause of an American butterfly's extinction, the way over-hunting and egg-collecting clearly wiped out birds like the great auk. Typically, butterfly species have been imperiled by the same, sometimes interrelated forces that threaten the Lang's metal mark today: habitat loss or habitat fragmentation, and invasive species. As early as 1875, in fact, Hans Hermann Baer, the absent-minded physician, believed that the Xerces blue, a brilliantly blue-winged butterfly found only in San Francisco, had been driven extinct by the city's expansion. The Xerces was a sand dune species, but its habitat was changing from open sand to residential neighborhoods in Baer's lifetime. The locality where it used to be found, he complained, is converted into building lots. And the only insects that might survive in such a place were the louse and flea. For Baer, it was only one example of how quickly the natural beauty of the Bay Area was disintegrating. James Cottle was barely a teenager when Baer lodged these complaints. The landscape that Cottle's mentor now saw as spoiled was the only one that Cottle had ever known. Nevertheless, by 1928, an aging Cottle felt the same way Baer had at the end of his life, like he'd watched the beautiful terrain of his youth crumble into an ecological ruin. All his favorite butterfly collecting spots in San Francisco had been erased forever by the city's growth, Cottle wrote, rendered sterile and worthless, destroyed, defiled, eradicated. He saw scarcely any turf left and focused instead on one day joining his mentor, Dr. Baer, in heaven. Cottle pictured Baer and all the other old collectors who'd preceded him waiting for him in the afterlife, staking out a tract of prime butterfly habitat with nets enough to go around. Liam O'Brien was doing his survey of San Francisco nearly 80 years later, in 2007. He counted 32 species and subspecies of butterflies, about two-thirds of what had been there when Cottle started collecting in the city. In San Francisco, Liam told me, we're known for what we've lost. The Xerces blue, in particular, stands as a chastising symbol. The nation's major invertebrate conservation nonprofit, the Xerces Society, is named for it. It ultimately became the first American butterfly known to be wiped out by humans, though it hung on in San Francisco many decades longer than expected. The butterfly had been presumed extinct for years when, in 1941, two young entomologists happened upon a small number of Xerces near a creek in San Francisco's Presidio. Ecstatic to see the butterfly still alive, they netted and killed large numbers of specimens to trade with their friends. It was the last time the butterfly was ever seen. "I always thought there would be more," one of the entomologists told a reporter near the end of his life. "I was wrong." His name was William Harry Lang. A few years before the Xerces incident, he discovered a new kind of metal mark at Antioch Dunes. Harry Lang, as he was known, was another native San Franciscan butterfly buff. He was born in 1912 and grew up collecting butterflies before school with an obsessive glee. At the same time, mind you, that James Cottle was on his way out, growing convinced that the city had been trashed. In fact, Lang went to high school within a couple of miles of several other budding entomologists, all of whom were so enraptured by the insects they found while tromping through their city neighborhoods that they pursued the science in college and quickly made names for themselves in the field. The 1930s and early 1940s, the years just after Cottle's death, are now considered a golden era for the science in the Bay Area. When Harry Lang netted his first Lang's Medal mark at Antioch Dunes in 1933, he was merely one in an eager army of young men out there, scouring new and mesmerizing critters from the sand. During the Depression, it was difficult for entomologists to travel to far-flung places for research. The Antioch Dunes emerged as an alternative study site for entomologists at the universities in Berkeley and Davis, and an endlessly fascinating one. At one time, there may have been as many as 4,000 or 5,000 insect species living there, sewn symbiotically into the ecosystem. It couldn't have been a more convenient place to study, either. At the edge of the dunes was a bar called the Little Corral, whose owner allowed the men to park their Model A's there as long as they bought a beer first, and after a long day of work, they could take swims or go fishing in the river. Consequently, probably no place in North America of such a small size has been scrutinized by entomologists so thoroughly over so many years. By Labor Day weekend, 1954, the dunes were so well known that when a regional chapter of the Lepidopterist Society had its annual meeting in San Francisco, organizing a field trip to Antioch was a no-brainer. The Lepidopterists were coming to see the Lang's Medal mark, and everyone managed to catch one and take it home. Still, Jerry Powell, an undergraduate at Berkeley at the time, later remembered being surprised that the generation just ahead of him, Harry Lang's generation, had written off the dunes by then. To them, the place was destroyed. There had already been decades of intermittent sand mining by that time. It began in earnest after the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, when bricks were needed to rebuild the city. But it was especially vigorous when Jerry Powell first arrived. At times, two separate companies were hauling sand from five different areas of the dunes at once, shipping it out by truck, river barge, or train. Spurs ran from the nearby railway to the area between the two power line towers, and sand was being shoveled out of that area most intensively, straight onto rail cars. A small depression was just starting to be noticeable there, the beginnings of the bowl-shaped valley that I'd find gaping between the power line towers on the property now. There had also been lots of industrial development around the dunes in the years after World War II, though according to Powell, the last straw for Lang's generation would be the construction of the gypsum plant in 1956. Not only did it sprout up in the middle of the habitat, splitting the dunes in half, but it cast white dust over the place, too. It felt, in a very visceral way, like an atrocity. It was all a matter of age and perspective, of course, all part of the same cycle of disillusionment that had been going on in San Francisco. The Lepidopterist Society trip was the first time Jerry Powell had ever been to the dunes, and he and the other students were just as excited by the place as Harry Lang and his contemporaries had been 20 years earlier. Just as Cottle loved the city that Bear wrote off, and Lang loved the city that Cottle wrote off, Powell now loved the dunes that Lang's generation wrote off. Powell didn't see a landscape sapped of life. He saw a terrific variety of insects, and he was sufficiently captivated to study the ecosystem on and off for decades as a professor at Berkeley. 2 decades later, though, by the mid-70s, development had winnowed down the dunes even more dramatically. Weeds were rampant, and another recent surge of sand mining had eaten farther into the property than ever before. But Powell was still intrigued. In 1976, he began what could have been a culmination of his research at Antioch Dunes, a study to plot the decline or disappearance of insect species at the dunes since the early 1930s, to describe how that web of life broke down. Because the dunes had been visited so regularly by entomologists, Powell assumed that the specimens they collected in any given era were a good reflection of the insect life that existed there then. So he and his students searched through museums, where specimens were labeled with information about where and when they were caught, and tallied all the samples brought home from Antioch in 2 7-year periods, a decade apart, starting in the 1930s. Meanwhile, Powell made his own trips to the dunes for the next 7 years, collecting everything he could. Now he had samples from 3 7-year time periods, a chronological catalog of what was netted at the Antioch dunes on some 600 different days between 1933 and 1983. By looking at when the species were last collected, he could narrow down when they vanished from the ecosystem. To make the study manageable, Powell had decided at the outset to look at only a fraction of the insect species known to exist at the dunes, 376 of them, which still took him 25 pages to list. Powell concluded that 243 of those 376 species were now gone. All manner of wasps, bee flies, beetles, robber flies, and velvet ants had disappeared. Among them were 4 species endemic to the dunes, species like the langs that can't be found anywhere else on Earth. That is, they were not just missing from Antioch, they were now globally extinct. But there was a serious wrinkle. Powell expected to show the number of species declining during those 50 years. Instead, his data showed the opposite. Even though many species disappeared, the total number of species being collected actually rose over time. Against all odds, biodiversity appeared to be increasing at Antioch Dunes. He soon realized this was an illusion. Powell thought about entomologists' nets, how in his lifetime their mesh had gotten finer and finer as scientists became interested in catching insects of smaller size. In the 30s, California was full of insects that hadn't been named, large, alluring, and conspicuous bugs that leapt out at you from the landscape. The boys of Lang's generation concentrated on the butterflies and dragonflies and wasps, the charismatic megafauna of the invertebrate world. As those larger insects lost their novelty, or their population declined and they became harder to find, the next generation was driven to root around for smaller, more obscure things, and so, in turn, was the generation after it. Over the years, the gaze of entomologists gradually magnified, each generation scrutinizing what the previous one hadn't bothered with or noticed. By the time Powell was surveying the dunes in the late 70s and early 80s, the insects he was bringing home included the minuscule and the nocturnal, because that's what a scientist of his generation was accustomed to collecting, and what was left to be caught. The biodiversity of the dunes hadn't expanded, but people's perception of it had. The phenomenon that Powell stumbled onto has a name: shifting baseline syndrome. The term was coined in 1995 by a fisheries scientist named Daniel Pauly. Pauly recognized that global fish populations have been slowly collapsing, and though scientists weren't blind to that damage, their vision was too narrow and subjective to take in its full extent. Every generation of scientists accepts the oceans as it inherits them, Pauly argued. Overfishing may eat away at fish stocks or even drive species extinct, but when the next generation of scientists start their careers, they don't see the oceans as depleted. That depleted condition becomes their baseline, against which they'll measure any subsequent losses in their lifetimes. Because of this, a comprehensive picture of the changes happening across generations never truly comes into focus. Scientists are concentrating on only part of a line graph that is, in fact, much longer and more steeply plunging. We now know, for example, that between 1850 and 2005, overfishing reduced the cod population in the northwestern Atlantic by some 92%. As we began to fish bigger species like cod into scarcity, we transitioned into eating smaller ones, like monkfish. As Pauly puts it, Humans are blindly fishing their way down the marine food web, not any differently from how entomologists blindly moved down the web of insects at Antioch Dunes, with Jerry Powell fascinated by the tiny bugs that his predecessors let pass through the mesh of their nets. When Pauly introduced the idea of shifting baseline syndrome in the 90s, he often joked to the press that kids might soon be enjoying jellyfish salad sandwiches instead of tuna. These days, he points out that there actually is a commercial jellyfish fishing industry up and running in Asia and the American Southeast. Shifting baseline syndrome, then, is only the scientific manifestation of a broader problem affecting all people, what the psychologist Peter H. Kahn Jr. has named environmental generational amnesia. All of us adopt the natural world we encounter in childhood as our psychological baseline, an expectation of how things should be, and gauge the changes we see against that norm. This explains why the children Kahn has interviewed in terribly polluted neighborhoods in Houston don't believe their neighborhoods are polluted, and why Kahn's daughter thinks the woods around their family cabin in Northern California are beautiful and pristine, while Kahn himself can't get over no longer hearing the calls of owls. It's also why Hans Hermann Baer and James Cottle, and even Liam O'Brien today, could all spend their lives equally entranced by a San Francisco butterfly scape that only got progressively poorer. As Kahn puts it, we don't know what we are missing. Acknowledging the problem of shifting baseline syndrome, like truly acknowledging the enormity of climate change, can be profoundly disruptive and discouraging. It begs the question of what baseline biologists should be measuring wildlife populations against in the first place. It can also leave us, the public, unsure how to feel about conservation's supposedly feel-good success stories. In 1973, when the bald eagle was placed on the endangered species list, there were believed to be only 417 nesting pairs of birds left in the lower 48 states. In 2007, Fish and Wildlife triumphantly delisted the eagle, having by then built that population up to 10,000 nesting pairs. But the agency also estimates that there may have been as many as 50,000 pairs in 1782, when the bird became America's national symbol. And there were doubtless more still when Columbus arrived in 1492, the year often used as a de facto baseline. So, do 10,000 eagle pairs represent a miraculous resurrection, or only a meager uptick after a much longer, more devastating decline? Is America flush with eagles? Are we still hopelessly deficient? How many eagles should there be? In 2005, a paper was published in the journal Nature that sought, in part, to settle this ambiguity. Its lead author was a then-graduate student named Josh Donlan. If the problem of shifting baselines was starting to feel unresolvable, like nothing could be objectively measured, like we were staring down into a vertiginous, infinitely receding series of subjective baselines, each invalidated by the one just behind it, then Donlan was ready to bring everyone back onto solid ground. Once, the paper explained, North America was teeming with spectacular prehistoric megafauna. Not just Thomas Jefferson's mammoths, but shaggy 18-foot-long ground sloths, dire wolves, and beavers the size of bears. There were humongous elk, saber-toothed cats, wild horses, and cheetahs. There were American lions bigger than present-day African lions, and a fleet of meat-eating birds circling overhead, waiting for all these hulking carcasses to drop. Virtually all of these species vanished at the end of the Pleistocene era, about 12,000 years ago. Why? In part, one hypothesis holds, it was because that was when humans, having arrived in North America over a land bridge from Asia, developed a new kind of stone spear tip called the Clovis Point and hunted them to extinction. Donlan and his colleagues argued that this Pleistocene extinction, and not Columbus's arrival in 1492, was North America's zero event, the moment when, ecologically speaking, everything started going wrong. If there was one scientifically defensible baseline for conservationists to agree on, this should be it. That megafauna had tremendous impacts on its ecosystems. Simply trundling around and displacing dirt would have changed the landscape in profound ways, providing habitat for other, smaller critters and insects. The absence of that megafauna has had repercussions too. For example, it allowed the animals those larger animals ate, like deer and other ungulates, to explode in number, setting in motion a suite of other disorderly consequences. In short, the loss of that megafauna has meant that, for the last 12,000 years, every human generation has inherited a North America that is profoundly out of whack. So many of the ecosystems we see, study, and appreciate like architecture are, in fact, mostly ruins, a disheveled set of ripple effects, reverberating from the loss of these big and influential beasts. All of this is well understood and not especially controversial. But Donlan and his co-authors were proposing bringing that megafauna back, or at least proxies for it. Their plan called for the importation of camels, tortoises, and horses, and then eventually cheetahs, elephants, and lions from Africa. The animals would be reintroduced on private property or at new, large fenced preserves on the Great Plains. They called the plan Pleistocene Rewilding. People object that Pleistocene rewilding would be playing God, Donlan told me. But my response is, we're already playing God. We're just not doing a very good job of it. The goal of too much conservation appears to be keeping the last threads of a lost world from fraying. Managing extinction, as Donlan puts it. We are afraid to interfere with nature or steer its course too dramatically on purpose. But we are meanwhile creating a nature full of highly adaptable weeds and pests by accident. We're not just eliminating the continent's wildlife, we are oafishly changing the composition of it, replacing its condors and panthers with more dandelions and rats. At the heart of Pleistocene rewilding was a contention that America could be so much more. Pleistocene rewilding became big news in the week after Donlan's proposal was published in 2005. He found himself discussing America's long-lost megafauna on morning television shows. It was probably the biggest ecological history lesson America has ever had, Donlan told me. A revelation for ordinary people to realize that their suburban neighborhoods were once run through with camels and lions. But then Hurricane Katrina hit, and the media turned their attention elsewhere. Donlan also got letters, hundreds of letters and emails, calling the idea moronic, scolding him for wanting to release killers in our homeland, or for proposing to pillage Africa's wildlife in order to beautify the Great Plains. People worried their children would be gobbled up while taking a hike, and detailed exactly what kind of firearm they'd use to gun down trespassing elephants. On the one hand, Pleistocene rewilding is completely logical. If you followed history far back enough, if you peeled back all those nostalgic baselines we are burdened with, one by one, you'd arrive exactly where Donlan had. You would see the rationality of what he was proposing. But if I was learning anything, it was that rationality hardly matters when it comes to the dark comedy of people and wild animals in America. Just a note to let you know, one man wrote to Donlan, that those of us who actually work for a living think you are a colossal asshat. One afternoon, I was working at Antioch Dunes with a group of high-ranking Fish and Wildlife Service employees when an old man suddenly appeared over a small ridge, walking briskly. He wore a striped dress shirt and a fishing hat, with a pair of binoculars clipped to his belt. Blood was running down his forearm. It looked as though he'd opened up a network of scabs, but he didn't seem troubled by this. Everyone in our party turned and stared. People don't just walk around the Antioch Dunes. The refuge is usually closed to the public. Then the refuge biologist, Susan Ewing, said, "That's Dr. Powell." Jerry Powell is still a professor emeritus at Berkeley. He is a standoffish man of 77 with a full head of white hair. It turns out that Powell has become one of Liam O'Brien's primary butterfly mentors. They frequently travel around California together in the summer, camping out and doing volunteer butterfly counts. When Liam gives talks about butterflies in San Francisco, Powell comes with his wife and afterward stoically points out inaccuracies. He's got antifreeze in his blood in a curmudgeonly, really fun way, Liam told me. I seriously think he's one of the coolest people I've ever met. I spent a couple of afternoons in Powell's office, asking him about the Antioch Dunes. He told me that any work to recover the Langs is decades beyond the point of diminishing returns, and even if it were possible, the agency's strategies were, in his opinion, completely misguided. For Powell, the Langs wasn't even the point. The butterfly had been singled out arbitrarily for federal protection, but it was only a remnant of a marvelous community of insects he'd watched waste away around it. I asked him to imagine he was in charge of managing the dunes. What would he do? He couldn't answer. So little of the habitat that made the place special is left, he said. That afternoon in Antioch, Powell was surveying the dunes as part of an annual nationwide butterfly count, a tally of all species, not just the Langs. Ewing had loaned him a key to the refuge gate, and he'd let himself in earlier that afternoon. He walked within 10 yards of our group without exactly approaching us, curious but seeming not to want to be the one who struck up the conversation. Finally, one of the government biologists called Powell over and asked him to take a look at some buckwheat plants. The leaves were snaked with rust-colored scars, and the fish and wildlife biologists suspected this was because the metalmark caterpillars were crawling up the stems and feeding on the leaves. To them, it was an encouraging sign. Powell disagreed. To him, it looked like a symptom of plant disease. I don't know what it is. It can't be doing this plant any good, he said. The man from Fish and Wildlife stared at the plant a while longer. Thanks for looking at that, he said. So, Susan Ewing said to Powell, trying to make conversation. That spring, Fish and Wildlife had experimented with trucking in cattle to eat the hairy vetch. Ewing now told him, The cattle are off the grazing area now. It's looking pretty good. It's working. Powell laughed. That was his only response. He'd stuck with the Antioch Dunes for so long, but seemed to have reached the same point of disillusionment with the place as his predecessors. Okay, Powell finally said. Well, good luck with it. Then he handed Ewing her key and left.